Good morning, everyone. Monday, August 24th, and again the National Broadcasting Company brings you a roundup of the latest domestic and foreign news with comments by NBC newsmen at home and overseas. We take you first to London for the report of John McVane.
This is London. The British are pleased at Brazil's entry into the war. Today's London Times points out the value of the Brazilian Navy in the war against the U-boats and the importance of the defense of South America's bulge, which has long been intended by the Axis as a stepping stone to the conquest of that continent. The Times says that Argentina and Chile maintain their own policies in the face of the danger that threatens. But these two countries, the Times says, will be impressed by the courageous step now taken by Brazil and her far-sighted president. London papers today are publishing feature articles about Brazil and the German attempts to build up a fifth column there. The Yorkshire Post today commends the British policy of keeping a strictly hands-off as regards Brazil. The British policy, as explained to the Yorkshire Post, was not to present any arguments to assist the Brazilian authorities' judgment. It's pointed out that Brazil made her own decisions on the basis of her own honor and Germany's provocation. The Post says Nazi Germany has chosen to make herself the world's outlaw. More and more widely, the challenge is being taken up. That is the chief and most hopeful meaning of Brazil's courageous decision. One British commentator asserts that the entry of Brazil means the South Atlantic coast refuge for submarines and raiders is cut out of the Nazi program. The writer adds that no supplies, except for the Allies, will have a chance of clearing the South Atlantic, and one of the greatest productive countries in the world now bars any but Allied markets. In the appointment of General Sir Henry Maitland Wilson as commander of the British forces in Iraq and Persia, British observers see preparations for the day when the British may be fighting side by side with the Russians in Asia Minor. Persia and Iraq are set up as a separate military area and detached from the rest of the Middle East command under General Alexander. The move frees Alexander from the burden of administration, but he still commands the British forces in Syria and the Ninth Army in Palestine. The Tenth Army is reported to be in Persia. It's said this army is being built into a heavy striking force, and in combination with the Red Army force in Persia, should someday be able to launch an offensive of real value. On the other hand, if the Germans can strike through the Caucasus, General Wilson's main task will be the defense of the Iraq and Persian oil fields. The appointment is one more phase of Mr. Churchill's shake-up of the Middle Eastern Command as a result of his recent visit. General Wilson worked with Wavell when the Italians were driven out of Cyrenaica. He led the expeditionary force to Greece and commanded in the Syrian campaign. He comes from a military family, and one of his ancestors was the Lord Cardigan, who led the charge of the Light Brigade. There's little news from General Alexander's forces in Egypt today. Ever since the Battle of France, Alexander's ability has marked him for a high command. By the time he took over in Burma, the campaign was lost, and he had no chance to do more than save as much as he could. Now he's in a key post. If he fails, a chief supply line to Russia will be cut, and the consequences will be far-reaching. But if Alexander can outsmart Rommel and win the North African coast for the Allies, he'll establish himself as one of the great commanders of the war. There's one result of Dieppe that might interest you. British listeners heard the Vichy and Paris radios announce yesterday that the German commander in France had transferred 10 million francs to the prefect of the department which contains Dieppe because the French people obeyed fighting French orders and didn't revolt. Marshal Pétain and Laval were quoted as expressing their heartfelt thanks to the German general. To see the incident in its proper perspective, remember that the French are paying the Germans millions of francs daily, and the Germans have systematically looted the entire country. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Now to the Russian capital to hear from the NBC reporter stationed there. Robert Magadoff reports from Moscow. Go ahead, Moscow.
This is Robert Magadoff speaking from Moscow. Heavy German forces crossed the Don right opposite Stalingrad and are trying violently to widen the gap and strike at the city. Simultaneously, the threat to the Volga capital from Kotelnikovo has grown as the Nazis followed up their advance yesterday by driving a fresh wedge during the night. Besides throwing in tremendous armored forces and huge concentrations of aircraft, The Germans are making wide use of that ancient and terrifying weapon, fire. Frequently, before an attack, when the west wind blows, the Germans set fire to the stubble and brushwood of the sun-baked steppe, starting something akin to our prairie fires. Driven by the wind, the flames spread, clearing minefields in the way of the Germans by making Soviet-laid mines explode. Behind a huge wall of fire and smoke, German tanks keep pressing on, and fascist soldiers wearing only shorts and boots are surging ahead, adding to the horror of it by savage shrieks and yells. Despite the violence of the German present offensive, Russian resistance is not weakening. There is every indication that the Red Army will give the Germans a fight for Stalingrad, no less costly to the Reichswehr than the battle for Moscow, a battle Hitler lost. The Russians are looking forward to Mr. Wilkie's forthcoming visit to Moscow. He'll be welcomed here both as the president's personal representative and as a representative of the American people. Russian as well as American circles in Moscow are confident that a great deal of good to Soviet-American relations will come of Mr. Wilkie's visit. The small American colony here looks forward to it with an eagerness all its own, hoping to hear some fresh news from home. Goodbye from Moscow.
Thank you, Robert Magadoff. Events at home are reported next by Ray Henley of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, speaking from the NBC newsroom in our nation's capital.
Army and Navy plane crashes yesterday took 28 lives. Two bombers and two other planes were lost. The biggest accident occurred in Virginia, near Washington, where 11 Navy flyers lost their lives when their huge flying boat, one of the PBYs, was believed struck by lightning. With tens of thousands of men in training and thousands of combat ships flying every day, these accidents are inevitable. Yet, accidents have been small in proportion to the number of planes in the air. Averaging it all out, there probably is as much chance for accidents on the ground with tanks or guns as in the air. Over the weekend, I talked with some of the officials who are trying to keep our transportation system going. The buses and streetcars, trucks, railroads, riverboats, and private automobiles. They are working especially hard on a plan to keep trucks in good mechanical order. There is a lot of point to this. There are only 75,000 new trucks available, and no more will be manufactured for the duration. And so a big voluntary movement of conservation has been sponsored by the government and is being carried out with the cooperation of truck manufacturing and fuel and tire companies. It is not an easy idea to get across. There just isn't anything very exciting about truck conservation, and so you don't read and hear enough about it. But as I looked into it, I found out how large groups of truck drivers and big and little truck owners are holding meetings in various cities, taking pledges to drive and handle their trucks carefully. I saw pictures of men, 200 or more of them in a group, in Albany, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and elsewhere, standing with right hands lifted, taking a solemn pledge. And here is part of the pledge these truck drivers are taking, and I quote, "I will do my part to see that frequent mechanical inspections are made, that all necessary adjustments and minor repairs are made promptly, so major repairs, wasting parts and materials, can be prevented. I will see that my truck is driven properly to avoid accidents, excessive tire wear, and gasoline waste." That's the pledge these truck drivers are taking with uplifted hand. Now it would seem that here we have an example for many of us who have been asking, what can I do? Some of us who ask that question may be inclined to think in terms of serving on some board, or getting a fancy job with an important-sounding title, or wearing a snappy uniform of some kind. And all the time, the green fields have been right at home. The answer to the question, what can I do, for a great many of us, lies in watching the little things that will stop waste, keeping what we have in good working condition, getting to know what is critical material and doing our best to conserve it. It's a campaign in which everyone can join, every housewife, every car owner, men and women in their offices and factories, and our young boys and girls. Those truck drivers and truck owners have set a good example. The combined effort of us all along similar lines will give us a job in this war, and it will mean more guns, planes, and tanks for our fighting men. The acting Speaker of the House, Representative Bullwinkle, is a little annoyed at what he calls the second front pressure boys. The North Carolinian says it's about time that everybody left military decisions to the military leaders. Representative Bullwinkle served actively in World War No. 1 and rose to a major. He is a student of military history, and he has dug up information that earlier American leaders, among them Washington, Lee, and Lincoln, also were plagued by so-called drugstore generals. Well, it looks like we're going to get at meat and other food shortages in a systematic way. The Department of Justice announces a plan to have housewife food wardens take up-to-date ideas on meat rationing and high cost of living problems direct into every household. A leader would be appointed for every block.
Well, now we take you to United Nations headquarters in Australia for a report by Sidney Albright.
Came over about midday at an altitude of 25,000 feet. Our fighters met them far out to sea. Describing the action, a correspondent reported that the Japs tried new tactics, but were instantly checkmated with new tactics. He said that a highly successful fighter technique has been evolved to cope, among other things, with the disadvantages due to high ceiling now favored by the Japanese. After the first pass at them by our fighters, three Jap bombers, before they were within sight of any possible objective, were seen to peel off from the formation and jettison their bombs in the ocean. 24 of the enemy bombers carried on towards the target area, but, said the correspondent, their marksmanship, though described as pattern bombing, might more correctly be styled as panic bombing. Another correspondent says, the story of the foiling of the bombers is a magnificent one of courage and endurance, 25,000 feet in the air, of white fighter pilots driving themselves on oxygen because of the rarefied atmosphere, even in the tropics at that height. It is the story of gun battles at such close quarters that the fighters were looking into the faces of their opponents as they shot them down. A number of the pilots in the Darwin fighter forces have already had extensive experience, both in the Philippines and Java. The 13 planes shot down comprised 4 bombers and 9 fighters, a high price to pay for what was accomplished, only slight damage to an aerodrome. The last large-scale raid on Darwin on July 30th was made by 49 planes. On that occasion, the Darwin fighter force bagged 9 enemy craft. Jap losses in raids and attempted raids on Darwin since the first attack in February now total 73. While this excellent record was being added to, Allied offensive reconnaissance in the northeastern sector struck at Fuka Passage in the Solomons. Buildings in the wharf area were bombed. Fuka Island, only 30 miles long, lies immediately north of Bougainville, where the Japanese are reported to be strongly fortified. It has already been pointed out that the capture of the enemy aerodrome on Guadalcanal Island has brought Bougainville within 90 minutes flying time from Allied bases. Warm praise of the help given by U.S. units to men of the cruiser Canberra when she was attacked in the Solomons has been expressed by survivors. One said that 2 U.S. destroyers took grave risks in drawing alongside the Canberra to transfer men, and that casualties would have been greater but for the splendid rescue work done. He added, not one man saved has failed to express his gratitude to the U.S. sailors who helped us to get away. Another survivor said that American sailors not only supplied them with clothing and other needs, but also subscribed $300 so that the stricken Australians could obtain cigarettes and other items from the canteen. This is Sidney Albright speaking from Australia.
These were the reports by John McVane from London, Robert Magadoff from Moscow, Ray Henley from Washington, and Sidney Albright from Australia. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.